Blog Talk Radio.
Yourself in danger when you're threatened by a stranger, when it looks like you will take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with a Chicken Whisperer radio show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program, and editor-in-chief of Chicken Whisperer magazine. Today is Monday, February 2nd, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, I welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com, or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
Do you provide a heat source for your backyard chickens in the winter? In most cases, it's not necessary. But if you choose to provide a heat source for your backyard chickens, it's imperative to use a safe and effective heat source, and the only one I recommend is the Sweeter Heater. The Sweeter Heater is a safe, completely sealed, washable, non-breakable, energy-efficient, long-lasting, and reliable specific area heater that comes with a 3-year warranty. Ditch the dangerous heat lamp this season and invest in the only heater I recommend, the Sweeter Heater. Purchase the Sweeter Heater online at sweeterheater.com. That's sweeterheater.com.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937.
Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. As stated in the chat room, I apologize for the longer delays between the commercials. I was having some technical difficulty here, and then I thought I had it fixed, and then when I got done with the commercials to come back live, then I had another problem. So it was a little dead air there, but I think I got it all fixed up and repaired, so shouldn't happen the rest of the broadcast. But, you know, live radio, you know, and been doing this enough now, entering our sixth year of broadcasting, and yeah, I've been down that road before. So nonetheless, I'm here. You're here. It is Monday, but don't let that get you down. We've got a great show today. Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of First State Vet Supply, is going to be joining us here in just a few minutes, and we're going to be talking all about really advanced incubation and really problem solving, unhatched dead chicks and where they died along the development, and why they didn't hatch. So it's going to be a very interesting show. Get those Chicken Whisperer notebooks out, and get ready to take a lot of notes, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of great information during today's broadcast. So thanks for joining us. Hope you had a great weekend. Mine was best as could be expected, I guess. Y'all remember my uncle passed away 2 weeks ago, Saturday, the January 18th, and this past Saturday was actually his memorial service. So we made the trip on the road up there, and attended that. It was good to see some family I hadn't seen in a while and whatnot. So we made the best of it. We had some tears, we had some laughs, but overall we did what we had to do. So appreciate all the thoughts and prayers that posted on my Facebook page. I do appreciate that. But today is Monday and it's the beginning of a new week. Let me just look at the lineup for this week to give you kind of a heads up. Of course, today Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor. Tomorrow is, remember, a special evening show, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, all about quail with the quail lady. She'll be joining us again after a couple of weeks of non-shows based on my scheduling issues. So tomorrow night, 8 p.m., all about quail with the quail lady. And then this Wednesday, garden-wise, living with Arlena, same time, 12 noon. Thursday, poultry today with Dr. McCray, this Thursday at noon. And so we have a full lineup all week. Just remember, 8 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday night, special time. Other than that, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, as always. Yes, we launched a brand new Ultimate Chicken Coop contest last night for the month of February. We had a wonderful, wonderful coop contest for January, and that contest is now over. We did announce the winner. It was Cassandra Strickland from Portland, Oregon. And finally made contact with her Friday afternoon. She was ecstatic, never won anything in her life, has a young daughter that's, I think, 6 years old, 5 or 6 years old. They just moved into a house, and they have a big backyard, and they said, this would be perfect for chickens. We need to do something. They entered the contest, and they won a boatload of chicken-related prizes. I've contacted all the sponsors with her shipping information. Things should start rolling her way this week. Incubator, brooder heater, books, gift cards, gift certificates, coop, feed and water station, Redoodle's artwork, absolutely amazing, $2,844. And that does not include the factoring in the cost of a lifetime print membership to Chicken Whisperer magazine. How cool is that? So she was a happy, happy, happy camper, to say the least. But we started a brand new chicken coop contest last night for the month of February from Urban Chicken Coop Company. And really proud to have them on as a sponsor for the February contest. I've been posting about it over on our Facebook page. You can go take a look at that. Pretty much entering is really the same way to do it. And urbancoopcompany.com is where you can find the company that's providing the coop. And again, we're starting off this month with just the coop. Just the coop. And I'll have many contests throughout the month on our Facebook page, which will give the listeners, give our fans the opportunity to add to the grand prize package, which I anticipate will be back up there over the $2,000 mark or pretty darn near close to it. Sponsors include, of course, GQF and Brenzy Sweeter Heater, the Chicken Fountain, the Peck and Play, the Foul Play products, McMurray Hatchery, Stromberg's Chickens. So it's going to be another. You can find this nowhere else, nowhere. We are often imitated but never duplicated, folks, and I have more chicken coop contests than anybody on the planet, always have, always will. That's just the way it is. So I hope you enjoy it. We had over 17,000 entries in January. We hope to have another 20,000 for February and continue that. So thank you very much for entering. Yes, people win these contests. Cassandra is going to be posting pictures as she gets a few of the prizes in the mail, and she promised she'll take pictures of the coop when it is delivered, all set up, the whole nine yards. So you got to love that. Looking forward to that as well. But, hey, it's a new month. It's a new contest. Yes, you have to enter again. All the rules are on our Facebook page, but I'll tell you how to do it right now, very simply, very quickly, because we got Peter who's just called in, and we got to get to some learning about advanced incubation. So this is how you enter the February Ultimate Chicken Coop Contest, my friends. All you got to do is send an email. That's it. How simple. Send an email to contest@chickenwhisperer.com. That's contest@chickenwhisperer.com. In the subject line of the email, put Coop Contest. Within the email itself, I need your name, your shipping address, and your phone number, and then hit send. That's it. One entry per person, okay? Yes, you and your husband can enter, but you must have different email addresses, okay? If you have 10 people in your household, all 10 can enter, but that should be 10. You can have your whole subdivision enter for you, and let's say you have 200 homes in that subdivision, 200 separate email addresses. Duplicate email addresses will be deleted, disqualified. Goodbye. Thanks for playing. Try again later. So, that's the way that works. Yes, you have to enter again. Even though you entered for January, that's a whole other month. Bye-bye. Gone. See ya. Sayonara. This is February. New contest. New entry. Okay? Also, when you enter via email, you will get an auto-reply. Maybe within 5 seconds, maybe within 5 minutes, maybe within 5 days, but you will automatically get a reply email saying that we received your entry and a link to subscribe either digitally or to the print edition of Chicken Whisperer magazine. So when you enter, be on the lookout for that. If you have not already, click on that link, and you can subscribe to the free, yes, you heard that right, free digital subscription to Chicken Whisperer magazine, which, of course, will be launched in March, or you can pay the very nominal $9.95 and get the print edition of Chicken Whisperer magazine delivered right to your mailbox. How cool is that? What a great value. I know a lot of people like the print. They like the touchy-feely of the magazine, the reading, the sitting in the easy chair. But some folks just like to have it on their iPad or their iPhone or their BlackBerry or their laptop or their desktop or however other way you want it delivered digitally, and that's perfectly fine. A lot of people got both. So if they're on the road, they can read it. Okay. If they're at work in the restroom, they can read it. I guess you can do that with either the print or the digital, but anyway, a lot of people order both, so thank you very much. Let's see, and again, the digital, it's the same thing. So you're not missing anything. It's not condensed. Things aren't missing. It's the exact same page per page as the print. It's just digitally delivered, probably via email, sent right to you. It's free, so take advantage of that. All righty, it is time to move on with today's show. I've got Peter Brown also known as the Chicken Doctor Founder. FirstStateVetSupply.com. They don't have it. Guess what? You don't need it. So let's go ahead and bring him on live, and let's go ahead and give him a big Chicken Whisper. Hey, Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Andy, how's it going today?
It's going pretty good. It's another week, and it is, man, how's it going? I'm in South Florida. It's 82 degrees and sunny. We might even hit 84 today, so no, I'm not complaining. Won't hear me complain one bit.
No complaints there, eh?
No, definitely not. So we're looking also at hitting the road. We're going to be leaving here, kind of sad to say, around the 24th of, or on the 24th of February, heading up to Atlanta for a big national webinar, and then hitting the road for this Tractor Supply tour. And don't think we'll be hitting your neck of the woods this tour, but it looks like maybe late summer, early fall, we'll be heading up towards the northeast, and which may bring us through Maryland. So if that's the case, we may have to swing by and take a look at your setup. Today we're broadcasting live from inside Peter Brown's Coop. And it's very comfortable. We have leather chairs. Yeah, we have leather chairs where it's fully air conditioned and absolutely. Gotta love it.
We may do that. We may set that up. We'll have to see how it all works out.
Yep, I'll make sure that, well, actually, you know, traveling on the road, I don't travel with my chickens, so it'll be biosecurity safe. Because I won't have walked out of my coop and walked into your coop, so we'll be good to go there. But if that happens, if we come within a reasonable distance of your pad there, then
sure.
We'll make sure we have to stop by and do a live broadcast
sure.
on location.
Yeah, our humble abode. Yeah, we're trying to do a few things here, you know, differently, and you know, it's been a little bit of a challenge. I got a late start doing some of the things, and some of the things haven't been done the way I, you know, would like to have them done. You know, the while all the frames for the agricultural frames on the outside, you know, perimeter of the fence, they're all installed. There's nothing growing in them, and it would have been nice to have had those beds prepared with something in it, but it just wasn't doable. Just from a time standpoint, it got so cold, nothing would grow in it anyway. And we've been thinking about some of the soaked fodder type things, but you know, I don't have to, neither one of us at this moment have the time to play around with it too much, and so they'll just have to suffer eating chicken feed. And and it's raining like cats and dogs here today anyway, so they're not wanting to go outside. Not even the duck doesn't even want any part of it. So just the way it is. So, but I will tell you one thing. Our suite of heaters have, you know, made a difference. We did have to, you know, put a little bit of heat in the coop during the cold snap that we had. But as far as the individual chickens themselves being taken care of by the suite of heaters, the heat was really only necessary for somewhat our own psychological effects. Of having them in a coop where it did get pretty chilly. But we also have four cats on the opposite end that needed a little bit of heat. So, and again, we didn't keep it crazy in there. We were very easily able to bring the temperature up and keep it at 40, 45 degrees. That's all we were looking for. We still had the suite of heaters on. They were all huddled up right under it, and nobody budged.
Yeah.
And not a frozen comb or tootsie in the place. So, they did their job. Would have done it without any other supplemental heat, but like I said, the other supplemental heat was really for the cats more than anything else. We have four outside cats that have access to the backside of this coop. They don't have access to the chickens or anything like that. Although it's a funny thing, some of these cats have grown up with these chickens and are perfectly content. Sitting in the chicken yard and during the day and they don't bother anybody. It's kind of an interesting thing. But as a general rule, they don't have access. They have their own little yard that we set up for them. Tammy does let them roam into the chicken yard on occasion without any trepidation at all. But as far as, you know, like I say, the heat was only really for the cats more than anything, and you couldn't do one without the other because of the way the whole place is set up. So,
I bet you don't have a mice problem there either.
Nope. Nope, don't have that either.
Mice and rodents, you can forget that. We saw the cats around. And
had a little bit more of a fly problem this summer than we wanted, and it wasn't brutal, but we're going to head that off at the pass this coming spring, and we've got a few things, and we'll share what we do there and what we use and how it all shakes out at the end of the day. So there'll be good things coming. Everything that I want to try doing, like our roosting material and everything else, we'll share all that with you, how it's working, whether we like it, don't like it, you know, what it would have changed, if anything, so on and so forth. So all that's coming, just haven't gotten around to doing it yet. And and it's not going to be one of those things, this is the way to do it, this is the way we do it. If it fits your operation or your pocketbook or your thought process of what you can or can't do, then that's fine. And if it doesn't, then that's okay, too. Nobody's going to argue a point on it either way. And
my neighbor had a neighbor across the street when we were living up in Atlanta, and every weekend, even some during the week, we'd be working outside, planting this, planting that, you know, getting everything, you know, putting in a koi pond, whatever. And he was a great guy. We became pretty good friends, and he was retired. And he would always kind of shout over the road. He's like, "Remember, Andy, Rome wasn't built in a day." Oh, man. Rome wasn't built in a day.
And it certainly wasn't built in a day around this place either, Chris. I get 14 different projects going. There are some days where I just don't feel like doing anything. And it just happens that way sometimes. I guess everybody can attest to the same type of a procedure. I've been running on full bore for quite a few years, and I thought after my heart attack I would have, you know, cut back some, but I did for a little bit, but I'm back up to doing crazy hours and trying to rethink that process. But it's hard to get yourself out of that mode when you're used to it all your life. You know, I've always been an early riser, and it's kind of like the way pardon?
I think everybody who's listening right now would probably agree to this, if not the vast majority, is that and that if you if something happens like that, life changing event, or maybe you just you retire from 40 years of working the same, whatever the case may be, that I think a lot of us have seen where if they just okay, that's it, and then just sit in front of the TV for the rest of the days, they don't last very long. You know, they just wither away to nothing so quickly too. In some cases, where it seems like if they continue hobbies or continue to work on the side or whatever, stay busy, that they thrive. But we've seen it where they just whatever they give up, or they just okay, I'm retired now. What? I think that's one reason why Jen's mom worked so long. I think it was like 52 years at the same company, and she was afraid to retire. She was like, maybe this year, maybe, you know, just because, you know, what am I going to do? And but I think everybody listening can relate to that or agree with that or has seen that in one way or another, either family or friends or something. So, but yeah, staying busy, I think, does have its benefits, I guess.
I know this isn't what the show today was about, but it's one of those things about basically not being able to turn it off. For me, what has always driven me to what I do for a living at this point is the fact that I enjoy the hunt. You see, it's not about dollars and cents for me. You know that, and a lot of people know that. It is about the ability to take a given situation and, to the best of my knowledge and ability and my skills, solve the problem. And I've been doing that all my life, whether it be human or otherwise. And it's pretty hard to turn it off because I'm always trying to see, you know, what's around the next corner. What can I do to make this particular situation better, or how do we go about making it better, or what can we find to make it better, or get us past this particular situation. Sometimes there isn't any answer, and that's the frustrating part of what I do, and it makes me angry with myself sometimes when I can't fix something that I think in some way, shape, or form should be fixable. But Yeah, you keep working, you keep trudging along, and I do enjoy, you know, what I do. That's the driving force for me behind it. It's kind of like a dog on a fox hunt, you know, and they enjoy running around trying to catch the fox. Well, it's kind of that way for me, and except I deal with chickens. And
yep, in 20 years, and in 20 years, you'll hear me sign on. This is the Chicken Whisperer. Today we've got Peter Brown broadcasting directly from Silver Oaks Retirement Community, and today we're going to cover coccidiosis for the 795th time. And
well,
but we love doing it, so we'll be doing it when we're old and gray, and absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, I I certainly hope that at that point in time, which would make me 88 years old, that I would be, still able to talk and do the things that I do today, where predominantly most of it comes from the top of my head, you know, what I from what I've done and what I've researched out and what have you. So, as far as that's concerned, I bet you didn't know this. This Thursday, I believe, is the second, not that it's something you want to jump up and down about, but the second anniversary of my heart attack. I believe it, 2 years ago.
2 years ago, wow.
Yeah, already.
2 years
already.
Ago.
You know, and driven there, not to belabor the point here, but driven there, you know, once that happened to me, number one, it was a shock, and number two, I don't mind telling anybody, I was scared to death. And anybody that's been through an episode like that and wasn't scared, there must be something wrong with them and need to go seek psychiatric help somewhere. But, after researching everything out and getting on a program, I've been maintaining my weight, my cholesterol, my triglycerides, all of that stuff now, since right after it happened. Got right on a program, mm-hmm. self-designed, still doing it. I still watch what I eat very, very closely. But I don't consider it a diet because I'm never hungry. If I'm hungry, I eat. I don't count calories and weigh food. I just eat the proper foods every day from my perspective. There are other people that might argue some points about it, but that's okay. I'm the one that's maintaining weight loss without starving to death, and I'm the one that has lost a total of 47 pounds. And feel good about what I did, feel good every day, and I still continue to exercise every day, which is, for me, a very important part of the program, that I've mm-hmm. put in place, and have a clean bill of health from my cardiologist with no restrictions. So, when you look at it, in all honesty, 2 years ago, I was dead on the ground. So
dead as a doornail as a former paramedic. I can tell you that for sure.
So from that standpoint, when you start looking at it, it is a significant accomplishment, and I just keep moving forward and just do the best I can with what I'm doing. But I'll tell you this: in the research that I did do concerning heart attacks and so on. A lot of this can be related to age and everything else. The article that I read didn't specify, but on average, most people who have a heart attack don't live another 5 years, about 25% of them. So it's not most, but it's a quarter of them, and that's significant. And I made a promise to myself I didn't want to be in that 25%. So at any rate, without further ado, we will get on to something else people more interested in than that nonsense we were just talking about. But I've had the opportunity to field a lot of questions lately about incubation, and we've been over it in different categories a number of times. And I don't think I can stress enough how important it is to take care of your breeding stock. So we'll spend a few minutes here talking about things that you might want to do or check with your breeders to make sure that they are up to the task at hand. Nutrition is a huge part of the incubation process. Most people don't think so because they don't think of it in those particular terms. but if the birds, the breeder flock nutrition is not up to snuff, then the chicks are not going to be up to snuff. It's pretty straightforward, pretty simple. But most people who have incubation problems always want to look at the problem being the incubator. Are those damn eggs I got that were shipped in or whatever? And certainly could be, because shipped eggs, in many cases, when do they hatch at all? But so with all of this stuff taken into consideration, the nutrition of your flock is extremely important. If I were in charge of a breeding flock at this point in time, I would make sure that they got no treats of any kind, nothing extra, other than maybe some supplementation with some amino acids and some chelated minerals and some vitamins on a regular basis. And part of the reason for that is that even though you may be feeding the best feed that is available on the face of the earth, you notice I said available. All feedstuffs in all portions, all sections of the country are not created equal. Right now, I would be, in my own estimation, maybe a little bit leery of some corn, because there's a lot of corn left over now from last year's crop, and the price of corn is dropping like a rock. And there's been a lot of talk in the agricultural communities about not raising as much corn this year, not planting as much, and not harvesting as much, because there's so much of the old corn from last year still out there, still in storage. So if you take all those things into consideration, one of the things you can take, the longer these feedstuffs hang around, whether it be corn, soybeans, or anything else, they like anything else, they start to degrade. So if you are using a feed ingredient that has been around and is a little on the old side, it may not contain the quality amino acids, the quality vitamins that it's supposed to by the standards that we use for judging these things in feed. So you may go to a manual and look it up, and a particular item is supposed to have X, Y, Z in it, and so much of each, and you're basing your formulation on that, when indeed the stuff that you're using may not. It doesn't, and it doesn't have to be. I'm not saying that you're going to have something that is going to be depleted by 50%, but even a small percentage in high-producing birds, and that's what your breeder hens and roosters are. They're high-producing. They're out there every day mating and laying eggs and everything else. And we've talked about it numerous times about the fact that, you know, a hen laying an egg is a monumental undertaking, a great physiological challenge to the hen herself. Taking at least 50% of the calcium in the body on a daily basis to put an eggshell around the contents of the egg. And so anywhere along the line that the bird becomes deficient, then they start pulling these things out of their body. She'll pull the calcium from her bones, she'll pull the protein off her breast and every place else, and you know, many times you go out and look at them, they look halfway decent in feather, but you pick them up and there's nothing to them. And certainly, you know, diseases and so on can all play a part in that scenario. But so no treats. I like to pre-supplement birds in the breeding category for at least 10 days, 2 weeks prior to putting the breeders together. That gives them an opportunity to prime their systems and have everything, so to speak, have the gas tanks all filled up on both sides, male and female, and get them ready for production and getting ready to get down to it and go to work. And you don't want to have those birds being supplemented with treats that takes away from the true nutritional value. You know, with the more scientific feeds that we have now, a lot of the things that you may read on the Internet about vitamin deficiencies and so on and so forth, as a general rule, they don't really take place anymore. They do when feedstuffs are deficient or birds are being fed a lot of treats and go away from the complete feed that they're being fed. So, you know, need to keep all of these things in mind because all of it, at the end of the day, will determine what quality of chick you end up with. And the better the quality, the less problems you'll have with these birds, the more they'll grow out to their genetic potential, and the greater the possibility that they'll reach the genetic potential that you've been striving for. You know, poor quality chicks just don't do well. They die early in many cases. They have more anomalies, more genetic problems seem to come through, which is related to problems during the hatching process as well, that can cause some of these genetic things to come out, the temperatures being raised and lowered at certain times, the can all make a difference in how the chicks turn out. And if the breeders aren't being treated right, and then the embryos don't develop properly, and even those that do tend to have more problems. We also said that 60% of the plus of the birds' immune systems lie in their intestinal tract. So you want to make sure that we're worm free. You want to make sure that where coccidiosis is under control. You want to make sure that they have no respiratory problems. No snotty noses, swollen faces, coughing, sneezing, any of those kinds of things, so that you can get the most production and the best quality chicks that's possible from these birds. So it may seem like I'm belaboring the point a little bit, but so many times, not only over the course of my career, but it continues to this day, where folks are just over-supplementing birds with junk. It's kind of like the junk food fad that's caught on for quite some years now with humans has caught on with chickens, and you know, they really just don't need it. I mean, there's a difference to it. If you're not worried about egg production and you're not worried about breeding them, then it really doesn't matter at the end of the day, you know, except for the fact that you may have some chickens that are really nutritionally not up to par. But as a general rule, the healthier the breeders are, the stronger the embryos are that develop, the stronger the chick is that comes out, the healthier the chick is, the less problems you're going to have with it, the less money you're going to spend on it for medications and so on and so forth. So it just makes good common sense to make sure that the breeders are in a position to give you all of the good quality eggs and embryos and so on that you need to go on with your program. It's hard to judge poor quality birds. And don't forget this little item either, that just because a chick has hatched out, dried off, and fluffed out, and now you got this little fur ball running around in the pen, their intestine is at least 2 weeks from completing its maturation process. So that first 2 weeks is critical in bring that chick now to a good, viable chick. Even though it might be healthy and strong now, certainly what you do with it going forward, especially the first 2 weeks, certainly mm-hmm. for its, you know, certainly for its lifetime, but that first 2 weeks is very, very critical, and I strongly recommend, you know, probiotics for birds on a fairly regular basis. And I realize that it's and it's an expensive process to do. Yogurt doesn't cut it. It's not strong enough. And many of the yogurts today, or at least the last that I've seen, a lot of them are not necessarily produced or have a live culture in them when they're out there after they've been produced. So a few things to watch, a few things to look over from that standpoint. But don't forget the nutrition of the bird. If you're looking for good quality eggs, you're looking for good quality chicks, good, healthy chicks that are going to grow out into good, vibrant, strong, healthy birds. You certainly want to take care of that nutritional end. You want to look at the disease end, the coccidiosis, the worms, the respiratory problems. Mites is another one that can drag egg production down and, you know, drag a bird down real quick. So, and speaking about mites, there's a new kid on the block as far as mite control. Some folks still use malathion. We had this discussion the other day on I think it was Facebook, and I only bring it up because it's part of this particular process that we, you know, where you're going to want to get these birds into top-notch physical, mental and nutritional shape to get the job done for you. So, but so some people may use malathion. The problem with malathion is no one stinks to high heaven, and leaves a very strong, nasty odor. And secondly, it is a good contact killer, and that's it. By contact killer, what I mean is that once you spray it on the bird and it dries, it's done. There'll be no further action or killing action from that malathion. You would be better off to get a 10% permethrin if that's the route you want to go with spraying. And you can use the 10% permethrin and spray it on the birds where it has a residual activity, meaning that after it's dry, it continues to work. How long it continues to work depends on how dirty the bird gets. If you've got birds that like to take dust baths, probably not going to last more than a couple of weeks. But there are some cases where birds are pretty much inside, or some people keep their show birds in cages and stuff where they don't have they can't get down in deep litter and stuff and dirt, and it can last a lot longer period of time. It's also good for using on the premise walls. So when you do that kind of thing, you take care of the creepy crawlies that run up and down the wall, but you also take care of them on the birds. And even after it dries on the wall, it still continues to work. And the same thing applies there. As dust builds up on the wall, then the ability of it to have the residual activity goes away as well. A lot of folks use in frontline on the birds. Some people use Revolution. These are certainly more costly methods, but they are very effective and do work. The new guy on the block is a product called Elector. It's E-L-E-C-T-O-R. This product, to my knowledge, was originally developed for red mite control in Europe, and it is presently available here in this country. It has been for a while, and it's also used in dogs for controlling fleas and so on. And the active ingredient in that product is spinosad, and S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D, I believe. And up front, it's a little pricey. You can probably find it anywhere from, $112, $115 to where we're at about $120. And it's an 8-ounce bottle, and there are some good reports coming out now about folks that have used it. It is safe. There is no egg withdrawal on it. You don't have to remove the birds from the house when you want to spray it, either on the coop or certainly on the birds. So there's no... It's a very, very safe product. I guess that's what I'm really trying to say. And while the price might scare you away a little bit, it is extremely effective and extremely safe. And just to remind you, this particular is used in dogs. I believe it's an oral pill that they've got to take, if my memory serves me correctly on that one. But so that's the new guy on the block. So there are methodologies to take care of your mite problem. And that's certainly something that you're going to want to do when you're looking at breeder birds and their ability to put out good quality eggs and chicks for you. So then we turn a little bit to the incubation situation. And I'm a firm believer in, I always say, if you don't know what you had, you don't know what you cured. And kind of like the same thing goes for embryology, so to speak. If you don't know what caused the problem, then you can't fix the problem. So I'm a big fan of taking every egg that you can that doesn't hatch and breaking it out very carefully and taking a look at it and examining it and trying to determine what went wrong and then try to fix it. And the majority of these things are quite simple to fix. In a great preponderance of the time, it is indeed an incubation problem, as well as, in many other cases, it is a nutritional deficiency of some sort. The situation then lies in trying to determine what exactly was it nutritional, was it incubation, either too hot, too cold, and things of that nature. So knowing to a degree as best you can, and you'll only know this after you've done it for a while, but once you've done it for a while, you'll be able to put an egg in a saucer and look at it. You might need a magnifying glass in some cases to see some of the detail of the early embryonic development to give you a rough idea as to where the embryo was in relation to age when it died. And when you know those things, then you can be better armed to figure out when the timing was on it when it died. And there are specific things that it usually will point to what's wrong and allow you to start looking at those things in your own operation and adjusting them. I will say this, there is no greater place than attention to detail when you are incubating eggs, and I think Andy, you probably would concur with that. The slightest little thing sometimes can set off a whole batch of eggs that just don't hatch right or hatch at all, and it just doesn't take much. If you look at and I've said this before about the Verinci incubators, while they may be a high dollar incubator, the shape of that incubator is by far superior to all of the box incubators out there. Because if you just think about it, if you take a fan and hold it up and stand in front of it and then just move your hand away from a fan, and you'll see that as you further move your hands away from your body, there's less and less air to the sides. But if you move your hands obviously back and towards the front where the fan is blowing, you're going to get a lot more air. Same thing in an incubator. So in the upper corners and the bottom corners and down the sides and stuff, it is tougher for that air to circulate properly. Okay, it does a good job. I'm not knocking it. Just giving you an explanation of what it is. But with the shape of the Verinci incubator, that air is, there are no real dead spots. And it forces the air around the eggs in such a fashion that the temperature from one place where one egg is to the next egg varies very, very little, whereas in some of your box-type incubators, the eggs on the outsides of those up in the corners and stuff may not hatch as well, may not hatch at all in some cases, just depends. So the shape of the incubator, the type of incubator you're using, and so on and so forth, how well you pay attention to the directions that come with the incubator, how often you check it. And one of my pet peeves with folks who are incubating eggs is this incessant, and I mean incessant, need to candle eggs. And I don't understand why you just can't leave them in there and let them go, and what hatches, hatches. But at any rate, they, especially in your still air incubators and your smaller tabletop type incubators, once you take the top off, everything you've done for the last week or whatever is before you opened it up.
I have a question on that, because I know there's several people, maybe many people that are listening that have hatched a long time, and this does not apply to hatching in the classroom, because that's a completely different experience. You're not trying to get all of them to hatch. It's a whole experience from prep to day one of setting the eggs to the end. So a little bit different regarding candling and opening, educational. But the question for many people out there in their mind right now is, Doc, is that if I'm going to candle one time, and my goal for candling one time after, say, 5 days, 7 days, and we'll get your opinion on that, to determine which ones are developing and not, so I can trash the ones that aren't so they don't rot, blow up, and explode in my incubator during the next 20, or say the next 17 days or whatever the case may be. So what day do you recommend if they want to candle one time to weed out the ones that aren't developing so there's no risk of egg explosion?
Okay, that's a good question. It's a valid question. I'll tell you, from my own experience, the way it is done for the most part, and it may have changed since I was in that end of it, but we used to take out all of the whatever was a undeveloped egg and whatever. We used to because of time, I think, more than anything else. But we used to do it at 18 days transfer. When we transferred from the big incubator to the hatcher, we used to pull everything out then. There was a tabletop candling device. You'd take the trays out, put them on top of it momentarily. The light would go on. You'd pull out the things. We had a bucket of disinfect. We'd just drop them in a disinfect bucket. And that way, if they exploded, every now and then you'd get one that would explode and was ugly. But and then there was a tray that fit over top of them, and you flipped it over, and they were in the transfer tray and went into the hatcher, and we just did it that way. Probably a better answer is the days to stay away from it. I think that's probably more important because there are certain things going on. First off, these embryos are developing very rapidly. They only have 21 days to get this whole process done from becoming a group of undistinguishable cells to a full grown chick. And certain things that are happening, if you interfere with them, then you interfere basically with the ability of the embryo to hatch and possibly even develop. For instance, I don't like this stuff of the people where they put them in. And look, this is my own personal thing. People do what they want to their eggs, and I don't have any control over that. And but I'm talking about from myself. Just take this the second day of incubation for just for argument's sake, okay? And you want to mess around with the eggs and everything else. It's during that second day that the embryo actually turns itself over on the face of the yolk and changes its position. And here you are spinning this egg around in front of a candle just so you can see if there's anything growing in it, when you may be interfering with that process. There's also another day, which is the fourth day of incubation. We've talked about this before. This one we've done at least two or three times, I know. And this is the point when the the allantoic stalk it attaches to an area around the cloaca. And here you are spinning that egg around, and this thing is very, very fragile, developing, and this connection is being made, and you're spinning this whole thing around again, and you break that stalk, and it's not going to develop. It's just not going to happen. So it's some of these things that need to be, stay away from. Trying to think here. Hang on one second. The other time that you want to stay away from it is the ninth day. And, again, this is where the allantois is starting to surround and then come around the embryo. You don't want to disrupt that process either. Okay? And one of the others that is, to me, very, very important is the 17th day of incubation. The embryo is starting to prepare itself for hatching. And what I mean by that is that the embryo is making a move to point its beak towards its chick tooth and beak towards the air cell, and it is putting its, making sure that its head is under the right wing, which is the proper presentation for pipping the shell, the air cell, the shell, and using its wing and its neck muscles to push that shell off of the egg and liberate itself from the egg. So if you're interfering with that ability of that bird to get its head in that proper position by spinning it around, that's a time, when I just wouldn't do that. So any time in between those, I would be careful. If I was, spinning these eggs around, I would do it very gently and with as little fanfare as I could. But, every time you touch them, every time you pull them out of the incubator, you are disrupting the heat process and the your you're lowering the temperature of the incubator, you're lowering the humidity level, you're doing all these things, being very disruptive, in my personal opinion. That's my opinion and mine alone.
No.
But, you know, so I would pick some time anywhere in between those things, but if I did candle, I would be very careful in doing it.
Right. No, that's fine. We're going to go to commercial break, and like I said, don't discount your opinion because it's based on decades of experience and a vast amount of knowledge, so it may just be your opinion on paper, but the history and the education that backs that opinion is very important to me and all of our listeners. I have never personally had an egg explode in the incubator. I don't know how often it happens as far as, you know, how many percentage of people have had it happen. I've had close friends and other folks that have had it happen, say they, whatever the case may be, and stink from high heaven, nasty, you know, kind of gets everything in the incubator dirty, and the smell, my gosh, is just horrid. But so I don't think it's something that happens routinely. I mean, we've had eggs that haven't developed that have stayed the whole 21 days. They really have 24 days because we're still maybe open, one or two may hatch, and have had no problems. And then occasionally you'll see someone comment, oh, I just had an egg explode and I didn't take it out when I can't, whatever the case may be. So I don't think it's a widespread event that happens a whole lot. Maybe Lisa in the chat room, she incubates a lot. Maybe she can share in her history of incubating chicks how many times she's had one explode, if any, and all the time she's hatched out. So I just knew that that's what a lot of people were thinking about. When should I candle to see, to identify the ones that are not developing? Maybe they weren't fertile, whatever the case may be, so I can trash them and concentrate on the rest of them. And so that's different. And, of course, for the school teachers or homeschoolers that are listening, you know, we know that you want it to be a successful hatch. Jen has an article coming out in the magazine about incubating in the classroom and specifically about candling and things like that. And a little bit different there, your experience and the knowledge you're gaining and experience you want to have with that is a little different than some folks that are hatching for breeding or hatching for, you know, for different cases. And the goal is a little bit different. So we don't want you discouraged from maybe candling in the classroom as well. But so it's kind of totally different there. But all that information will be coming out in the magazine with Jen and hatching in the classroom. She's done it for a decade and has had success for that. She'll share with you some things, like she had a teacher that had an incubator with no turner in it, and it left it over the weekend. You know, that leaves Friday, comes back Monday, didn't turn the eggs. There for those, you know, however many weekends were scheduled in that 21-day period, and her hatch percentage by not doing that, things like that. So it's a little different animal, if you will, with hatching in the classroom than for a lot of folks, because the goals are maybe a little bit different. We're going to go to a commercial break. We are talking with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of First State Vet Supply. This last little segment, information you're not going to get anywhere. No blog, no forum, not Wikipedia, not Google. All this information about, you know, you probably don't want to hatch on this day because this is in development. You probably don't want to, or candle, you probably don't want a candle on this day because this is developing in the egg. So even when you're turning it, it's amazing information. It just, I love to hear that on the show because I know it's information our listeners right now are getting that they have probably never heard before in their life and are never going to get anywhere else. So I'm proud of that. I'm glad we have Peter on the radio show. We're going to go to commercial break. There's a lot more when we come back with Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor. Stay with us, folks.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg candlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea. Technology you can trust.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
How would you like a punch in the beak?
This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce. This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce. I'll don my super suit.
All right, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It's Monday, which means we've got Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, joining us. We're talking about really advanced incubation and signs to look for when you don't have a successful hatch. And, checking out the development of the chick along the way as far as when your hatch is complete, looking and seeing what stage it stopped developing, and kind of being a detective to see what you need to fix and improve with your incubation. So we are back live, and Doc, you've joined us now, so I'll turn it back over to you.
One of the other things I want to say here, we're getting into because we're going to talk about early deads today, so that end part of it here is not going to be all that long, but it is important to understand too how you handle the eggs prior to incubation is just about as important, if not important as how you handle them during incubation. Most people don't understand that conception takes place in the oviduct shortly after the ovum is ovulated, and really is starting to develop inside of the hen. And so 20 some odd hours later, she coughs up this egg that's been really incubating at 106 degrees for almost 24 hours, at least in the vicinity of 20 hours. So you already have the embryonic development starting, so most folks don't look at it that way. Most people don't think that there's anything going on to any degree until they put it in an incubator, and that's not true. Once you start rising above 55 degrees or so, give or take, the embryo will start to develop and continue on. It's always really going to be continuing on, but it's at such a slow rate at the lower temperatures. So one of the reasons that you may experience problems with shipped eggs is the temperature differential from one place to another, the time of year that the eggs are being shipped, cooler weather getting too cold, frozen, hotter weather being inside of a hot semi-trailer or wherever it's going, or sitting out on the tarmac somewhere at some airport waiting to be loaded into the belly of an airplane to make it to its final destination, and on the delivery truck at 110 degrees or whatever, that embryo is growing. And in some cases, if the temperature is too high, the embryo is going to die because of that. And so I think all of that needs to be taken into account here to try to get, you know, at the end of the day, the whole thing is about getting the best possible hatch you can and getting the best possible chick that you can out of that hatch or chicks. And that's really what it's all about. And the more you pay attention to detail and watch it, it doesn't mean you have to be anal, but you have to be cognizant of what's going on with these things and the fact that, you know, I know there are people out there, because I've talked to people, say, well, I just leave them on a counter and they're fine. And maybe where you live in your neck of the woods, for the type of moisture, as a matter of fact, Tammy and I were talking about that this morning here, where I live, it's so wet all the time, all the time. You know, even on a dry day, it's wet here. You know, you can't put anything here effectively in any kind of shed, even, you know, one that's really waterproof and doesn't really have anything, without eventually some of the stuff turning moldy. It's just the way it is here. The you know, roofs out in the middle of a field turn black after a few years from the mold that grows on them. It's just the way it is here. Everything is moldy to some degree. So everybody lives in a different area. I would say hatching eggs here in an incubator would be a little bit more of a challenge due to the excessive moisture that we have here on generally on a regular basis. So, you know, it's all of these things that need to be taken into consideration when you're incubating eggs. And when you don't take these things into consideration, then they don't come out the way you want them to. And so what we really, the crux of this whole thing today was really about early deads. And so if you break them out and you start looking at what is in the saucer that you're using, if we're looking at eggs that have no blood rings at all present, and so on, we can judge those eggs to be not fertile. They would have the germinal disc there and intact, but there wouldn't be anything growing basically from it. We can look at that egg and say it probably died somewhere in the category of within the first 24 to 48 hours. Okay, and then you have to go on a hunt to figure out what went wrong in the first 24 to 48 hours. So you go back and you review thing. And I'll tell you one thing that is a value in this whole thing. Take notes. Take notes so you don't, you know, make the same mistake the next time around when you go and you check your incubation. I don't know how many times people, you know, say, well, it was okay. Well, what's okay? You know, get a pad and put it where your incubator is, and when you go by there, you put the date you checked it, you put the time you checked it, and what the temperature was, what the humidity was. Maybe you want to hang around if you've got a turner in it to see the turner cycle, or you know when it's cycling, come by and check it, and the turner was working at 9 o'clock this morning, and the temperature was such, and the humidity was such, and, you know, just kind of a little checklist thing, you know, and then you can go back later on in your notes and see, or you can see whether something went wrong, and you can look at it and see if it was the eggs, was it the incubator, was it you, was it, the, you know, would your child come along and pull a plug out on something, or whatever. So you can have a record of these things that, you can go back and you can see what kind of hatch you got from the temperature, the humidity, the turning, the whole bit. You'll have a little bit of a record to judge, you know, where you need to go from there, if anywhere. You may be right on it, and a lot of people are. A lot of people do a real good job. So you wouldn't see any egg, blood rings or anything in this. So then we want to look at the possible causes. One of the things I would certainly look at is the nutritional health of my breeding flock right up front. I think that this whole thing of them not developing right on truly rings of a problem in the breeding flock. Possibly with nutrition. So I would certainly look at that. I would look at what I was feeding. Am I giving treats or not? Even one of these flock blocks that you got out in the yard, you know, I've seen birds go after those things and just stand there hour after hour just chomping away. Well, if they're chomping away at the flock block, they're not getting everything they need there because that's not what it's designed for. And so there need to be over where the complete feed is. That's why they call it a complete feed. All the vitamins, electrolytes, amino acids, protein, carbohydrates, fat, everything. It's all in there. It's all they need. And the rest of it is just generally for our own satisfaction because we have a tendency to want to treat ourselves the same way, and we treat them the same way, like a dog and a cat that's overweight and so on. So you want to look at that. So when you determine in your discovery process here that the breeder flock is okay, then we want to look at other possible causes. We want to take a look at our breeding stock as far as their age is concerned. These young guys, old guys, young gals, old gals, and assess that. I will say to you that if you have an older rooster that you're using, and I couldn't give you a break point because every breed is different as to the age, but you need to look at his ability to produce the amount of semen that is needed to give you the kind of fertility level that you're looking for. So my advice, if you determine that this is part of the problem, my advice to you is not to leave him in with the girls day in, day out. I wouldn't even leave him in there for more than a couple of hours. Watch him top all the hens a couple of times, pull him back out, and go let him rest. And bring him back over. Maybe if you did that, it's, let's say, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, bring him back over at 12 or 1, let him mate with everybody, and spend about an hour or so with the girls, back out. And you might want to bring him back in again and be, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, depending on the time of the year. Let him do his thing for another hour or less and put him away. I think that is the best way of preserving an older rooster who is not going to necessarily give you the fertility that you want because it's an age-related thing. So I would take a look at doing that. I would look at my eggs. I would look at the egg quality. I would look at the egg holding temperature. I would look at the humidity. I would look at the eggshell and that kind of thing. And again, when you break these eggs open, you'll be able to see all of these different things, okay? You'll be able to see all of that. You might want to get yourself a decent magnifying glass because some of these things, they will be there and you won't be able to see them not necessarily with the naked eye. But during the second day of incubation, you can actually, if you've got good eyesight and a good magnifying glass, you can usually end up seeing the heartbeat. Okay, and it starts right around in that second day. Certainly by the third day, you should be able to see that. And one of the most prominent things anybody's done any incubation at all and broken any kind of eggs open at all, the eye is always very prominent. So the eye will give you a heads up as to, number one, where the head is located and where the embryo is lying on the allantoic sac in relation to the yolk itself. So it's an interesting situation. Then you're going to want to look at your disease conditions with your birds, okay? Did you treat for coccidiosis? Do we have a bunch of loose droppings, so on and so forth? Do we have worms? Do we have mites? And this kind of thing. You're also going to want to look at the conditioning of the bird itself. Little fat boys running around don't really mate very well sometimes. And so you want to look at the overall weight of the bird in relation to where that particular breed should be.
Hey, now, I got two kids.
I was just talking about conditioning. Run around the block.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But, you know, it's how you handle those eggs. You know, the longer the length of time that you held the eggs. If you have a small group of birds and you're trying to put a bunch of eggs in an incubator because you've promised somebody some chicks or you just want to get a lot of chicks, generally it's the ones that are the oldest that are going to give you the most trouble, as a general rule. And especially if they come from older birds, you start looking at birds that are producing eggshells that are a little thinner. The albumin in the egg can tend to be a little bit thinner sometimes as the bird ages as well. And that leads to instability within the egg itself. Handling it bounces around a little bit more. Eggs that are shipped that way that are from older birds or have been hanging around a while have more space inside of the egg to be sloshed back and forth and that kind of thing, and that ends up doing embryo damage and so on and so forth. Using sulfa drugs on birds that are producing eggs for hatching purposes is a no-no, okay? It causes mottled egg yolks as a general rule, so you want to stay away from that. If you need to treat for coccidiosis during the egg collection process from your breeders, you're going to want to use either the Ampril or the Cord. And for the 9 millionth time, there is no difference between Ampril and Cord. I don't care what you say. There is no difference. They are the same, manufactured by the same company, but I have people that swear one's better than the other. Whether you have the Cord liquid or powder or you have the Ampril liquid or powder, they are the same. They are the same strength. They're made by the same company. They are the same percentage, 20% for the powder, 9.6% for the liquid. The amount you would use of either one of them, Cord or Ampril, is exactly the same. And if you buy Ampril, has directions for chickens. If you buy Cord, it's a cattle product. So there is no difference as far as their efficacy is concerned whatsoever. I want to just bring that up for the 9 millionth and one time. And the other thing that we see sometimes with embryos that where we get this early mortality we can see some vitamin deficiencies. Most common too time-consuming to go into every little vitamin deficiency that's out there because of all the vitamins involved, and they don't all occur early on, but even if they do, generally if you have more than one vitamin deficiency early on, the embryo is probably not going to develop, and they become a little bit harder to figure out as far as that's concerned. That's why I recommend supplementation. Not the only reason, but one of the reasons why I recommend supplementation during the egg gathering process for breeders, so that you don't run into the vitamin deficiency type of a thing. You cover the bases. And I would say to all my silky friends out there too, as a special caveat here, it would behoove you to almost on a regular basis to supplement the diet of most silkies to prevent wry neck and some other conditions that seem to pop up more in that particular breed than any other. One of the ways I would do it, because of the fact that sometimes over-supplementation is not good either, I would look to do some sea kelp or something like that, where it has an abundance of minerals and vitamins, including selenium and vitamin E and all of those that are already in it. And you just kind of give it free choice. They eat a lot of it in the beginning, but they'll back away from it a little bit after a while and settle down. It's been a great product for that kind of supplementation. It's easy to do because you can put it out in a bowl, kind of like diatomaceous earth, and just leave it there and let them eat what they want. And so it's kind of like an almost natural supplementation type thing. Also, you can use the A-lite amino acids along with the Replimin liquid and the VitaPro, real good combination. It has been very, very strong in its ability to right the wrongs of amino acid deficiencies and vitamin and mineral deficiencies and so on. And the fact that the Replimin is a chelated product, that means the absorption is almost immediate. Within 12 to 24 hours, we usually see an improvement overall in the color of a bird's face and so on. I have a lot of people that are well-known breeders that use that particular product. to enhance the overall health and vigor of their flock. So that's basically what you're looking at, 1 or 2 days. When you get an egg breakout that you've done and you still have no blood, but you have a germinal disc now that is large, but it still doesn't have the normal venous system that we see, or what people call blood rings. This would generally means that, and nothing is absolute, but it, like I said before, you have to have a place to start, and this is one of them. Generally means the eggs are old. We see this a lot with eggs that were shipped, that were damaged in shipment, thrown around, shaken up quite a bit, and that kind of thing. And unfortunately, you know, putting fragile on a box, I think sometimes is an invitation for somebody to kick it from pillar to post. I really truly believe that. I don't think it alerts a person to the fact that they should use a little bit more care. And one of the other things that would cause this particular thing, so whether you have this enlarged germinal disc without any further development, early high incubator temperatures. It's one of the few times where early high incubator temperature is going to be extremely detrimental to you. Usually we look at high incubation temperatures at the end of the hatch being more detrimental because the embryo is growing, throwing off a lot of its own heat, and then you throw more heat on top of that over and above the normal, and then you start to really get some heavy mortality from that. And so going on now to what you might see on the third day, and give you a tip off as to the timing of when an embryo had died, there would be a blood ring present in a very small embryo, and this can be caused by, either high temperature, low temperature during the incubation process, the egg storage, improper overall temperature, then inbreeding of the flock as well. So, you know, now that you're armed with some of these things, the idea now will be to try to decide, and it's like you being a detective, and you look at these things and see what it is that would cause that mortality at that time, at 3 days, and look at your own operation and see if anything there applies to it. And it's kind of have to search around, be honest with yourself, and again, keeping good records really goes miles to you recollecting. Most people that we know of who have been at an accident scene or a scene of a robbery are very, the majority of the time, very inaccurate of the descriptions and so on and so forth. And I think the same applies lots of times, because when I talk to people, you know, when you ask them a particular question in relation to, you know, what the temperature was, and they'll say, well, it was normal. They never give you a number. It was normal. Well, what might be normal for one might not be normal for another. So it would behoove you to write it down so you'd have a written transcript, a written record so that you could fall back on. And that helps you. That helps you when you do have a problem, even if you don't have a problem. So it helps you when you do have that problem. You can look back on those records and you can say, okay, all right, everything was good here. The incubator was good. This was good. That was good. And you should be able to home in on what you what the problem is that's causing it. And Andy, that's about it for the early dead thing. Most of it from that point on is pretty much the same thing over and over. Is there any questions from anybody anywhere? Or?
There was one in the chat room here. How do you? Let me see. It scrolled up a little bit. How do you keep the chicks that hatched from rolling the pip days over when they hatch? They hatch out, and you know,
starts moving around a little bit, and all the eggs are rolling around. I don't know of a way you can stop that, actually, Christmas chick.
Yeah, I've never had to address that particular problem, but I guess the only other way to do it is, to have a separate small incubator, take them out of a cheap forced air incubator, just take them out of there and put them into that, let them dry off, so they don't
they don't
force the other eggs around. But I've never seen that be a problem, because if they're at the pipping stage, it shouldn't really be a problem for them getting out of the shell. If they're not getting out of the shell, it's probably because of really just a few factors. It is possible, and it happens all the time, that birds that came from nutritionally impaired breeding stock can make it almost to the end, but they never make it out. Okay, and they become your late deads. High temperature, low temperature, high humidity, low humidity, all of those things play a role as to whether or not that embryo will get out. Also, how you handled eggs in Canada. This goes back to what I was saying before. Okay, the proper presentation is the head or the beak and the chick tooth towards the air cell with the head under the right wing. Any other position is considered a breach. And in the majority of time, for those birds, they pip the shell and they never get out because they don't have the strength and the ability to spin themselves around in the shell and break it, and then with the wing not being there with the neck muscles to help push the shell off, they're just stuck, and they stay there, and then they die. And they may die anyway because they're not strong enough from nutritional deficiencies and so on in order to get out. So, again, it becomes, I don't think that there's any detrimental effect, thinking about it here just on the fly, because I've never encountered it before, and it has to a zillion chickens. I don't see that being a problem. Actuality, the stimulation from other birds moving around is an incentive for the birds that are pipping to get out. So I don't see them moving it around unless they're being aggressive. But I don't see it as a general rule being a problem. I've never encountered it anyway, from that standpoint.
Okay. I've got a question. There's another one that's going to be posed here. Because whenever we interview the big boys, the Murray Hatchery, the Ideal, the Mount Healthy Hatcheries, putting out millions of chicks every year, I always ask them when we have them on, what percentage of hatch do you consider successful? Because it seems like in the hobby farm level or the backyard chicken level, they set 42 eggs, they expect or want 42 eggs to hatch. They set 9, they want all 9 to hatch. They set their sportsman incubator up with 350, they want all 350 to hatch, and they think anything less than 90% is a failure. And so when I ask the bigwigs who are setting hundreds of thousands of chicks, they I think that the most number that I got, probably average from all these bigwigs, are 80 to 85% work for real. But realistically, it's going to be somewhere between 70 and 80% that actually hatch. But if we get 84, 85, 86%, we're ecstatic, and we're very pleased with that. When if you talk to somebody who said 100 eggs and they only had 85 hatch, and at the hobby level, they get disappointed. And I don't think that should be the case. I think that they, based on the fact that it's art and science combined, like you share with us, I think if they set a incubator with 42 eggs and they have 32 hatch, that they should consider that a success with all that has to go into it, like you just said earlier in the show. So I don't know what's your take on that when you got somebody that says, I set 42 and I only got 38 or 35. I'm very disappointed.
Yeah, I think that looking for 100% hatch is somewhat unrealistic. I have done it. Yeah, has it been more rare? Yes, because of the fact that there are so many variables that go into the incubation process. For instance, like we were talking about earlier, the egg handling is a huge part of it. I mean, you know, just bouncing them around and not being held at the right temperature, starting and stopping the embryo. In other words, you're shipping eggs out today, and the temperature is going to be down in the high 30s, low 40s, and then tomorrow it's going to be and it's not uncommon these days to be 70 degrees the next day. So these eggs are going from this high 30s, 40s degree temperature back up to 65, 70 degrees, and they're still in transit for 2 or 3 days, and they go back that following night down to 35 degrees, and they come back up the next day to 60 degrees. You're starting and stopping that embryo, and there aren't too many starts and stops before the car don't start, and, they die. So, I've said it before, I'll say it again, it's a wonder that that eggs that people get in that are shipped hatch at all. It's really, and I think it is a greater testament to the fact that the fresher the egg, the less the contents slosh around inside, even though it has the chalaza on both ends to hold it somewhat, but the more moisture loss from the egg, or the more viscous or loose, so to speak, the albumin in the egg, the more opportunity for it to slop around. So the fresher the egg, the greater the content of the egg. The more moisture is in it, the more albumin, which is the moisture in that egg, the thicker it is, the more protective overall it's going to be of that shipped egg. So there are many factors that go into it. If you have a backyard flock of chickens and you're, like you said, set 42 eggs and you're expecting 42 to hatch, I think it's just a little bit unrealistic. As far as specific breeds are concerned, that's a hard one. I don't know.
That's another question we got in the chat room right now. We have one, and we'll wrap it up with this question here. What you're leading to is that they have a very, I don't want to say poor percentage hatch, but they don't get near the percentage hatch when they're hatching the Marans, however you want to pronounce it, folks. So they, maybe because of the thickness of the shell, have you heard about that specific breed being a little bit more difficult?
I've heard people talk about it, but I think, again, if these folks who are hatching this particular breed of birds are concerned about that, then they need to go back and listen to this show and start looking for the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy that the shell is too hard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to buy that, because that chick tooth is pretty sharp. That bird's pretty strong. I'm thinking that what we're looking at is weak embryos that don't have the wherewithal to get out of that shell, or we're looking at birds that embryos that are in a breech position. Okay, one of the common breech positions is the head in between both legs. There is no way in God's green earth that bird is going to be able to get out of there. They may pip the shell, but they're not going any further than that. And the weaker the bird is, the higher the mortality rate's going to be. So
the dark color being pretty much a non-issue as well.
I don't think it has anything to do with it. I think it has everything to do with the strength of the embryo. I would look at what I was doing feeding wise. I would supplement prior to. If they want to get a hold of me, I'll try to help them with it. That's what this is all about. You know, I directed somebody last night from Facebook, and I won't say who it was or what group we were in, but that particular person was looking for some information on Rhinec. I sent her to the Blog Talk Radio site and told her what to look for. I couldn't remember what episode it was, but they found it, and they came back and said that they couldn't believe the information that's available on this site. And I was urging everybody on that particular site that we were involved in yesterday to go there and start listening to some of the shows. It's important to find out. If these birds were mine that are not hatching properly, I would be on it and trying to figure it out when they don't hatch, it would behoove you to break each and every one open. If you have a question about it, you can always people send me pictures every day of sick mm-hmm. birds, broken eggs, embryos, of all kinds of descriptions. That's how my library grows. I have a library before I started doing stuff on the internet and stuff on this radio show and people contacting me as much as they do now through the people that I've been associated with for the most part. Give an example, just comes to mind because I was helping somebody out the other day with some pigeon stuff, and Dr. David Tudor, who was at the Rutgers University and was a more of a pigeon guy, veterinarian, him and I were really close friends. When he died, or before he died, actually, he personally came down to my home and gave me his personal slide set. So it's those kinds of associations that I've had over the years that have allowed me to help develop my own career. But I have a library in excess of 10,000 slides of every kind of description you can think of, pretty much. There's a few I don't have, and I'm always developing stuff along those lines. But as we move closer and closer to getting some of these books done, which I'm working on, you'll be able to see every bit of this development that I'm talking about, and 'cause I have it all, and it's quite detailed.
Cool beans. Awesome information as always. And yes, I just killed a spider next to me, so that's what you heard.
Was that you? Was that you squawking?
That was me. I was like, oh, great, spider.
But whoever it is that asked that question about the Marans or Marans, however you want to pronounce it, I agree with you. I don't care about the pronouncement. I'm more interested in how do we get them to hatch, because it's doable. It's got to be. And I can't believe it would be the shell. Hey, I've been wrong on things before, but I've never, ever come across a... for instance, if you look at young birds, okay, young birds that just come into production and are producing fertile eggs, that's when their shells are the hardest, whether it be a white leghorn or a brown leghorn or a barred rock or something else. That's when their shells are the strongest right off the get-go, and they break out of them pretty easily. Generally, failure to get out of the egg goes back to the viability of the chick to start with. Okay, it wasn't strong enough to do that, or somebody candled it somewhere along the line when it was trying to get into the proper ova position, and didn't allow it to get the right the head under the right wing in preparation for pipping the shell and taking its first breath of air and getting out. All of those things, whatever we talked about here, every bit of it, they can go back and start looking at this stuff. And it, just like I said last week, if you're going to raise chickens, get the disease poster and start posting your own chickens and figuring out what's wrong, and it'll save you a lot of money in the long run. And I do realize that everybody can't do that. I understand that. Everybody doesn't have the intestinal fortitude to do such, and I understand it. But if you want to find out what's going on, you have to spend the time and the effort to break these eggs open when they don't hatch, every one of them, and find out where they died and try to make some decisions as to what you can change to make the whole situation better. And anybody needs my help, chickendr@firststatevetsupply.com. Clear pictures only. Other stuff will be deleted. Isn't worth it. So
exactly. All right, man. Thank you so much. Great information. Like I said before the commercial break, that was amazing information you're sharing, and you're not going to get anywhere else other than right here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Thanks so much, Peter, for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you in about a week.
Yep, my pleasure. Take care.
All right, thank you so much. Yep, that is Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. You can contact him, chickendr@firststatevetsupply.com. That's chickendr@firststatevetsupply.com. Take a look at his shop there, his online store. If they don't have it, you don't need it. So thank you very much for tuning in. That's going to wrap up another episode of Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Tune in tomorrow. We've got, actually don't remember, tomorrow, 8 p.m. show. We've got All About Quail with the Quail Lady, Alexandra Douglas. And tomorrow, Tuesday, an evening show, 8 p.m. So those of you who can't tune in live during the day, you may be able to tune in live tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then Wednesday, Garden Wise Living with Arlena. Thursday, Poultry Today with Dr. McRae. And we hope you have a fabulous rest of your day, and we hope to see you tomorrow, 8 p.m., right here on Blog Talk Radio. God bless everybody. Oh,